After her workout, Esme remembered that she needed to make an appointment to meet Admiral Dossignol. Now, while she was working her way through the basic level training cubes, would be an ideal time. She contacted Commander Adderin's clerk, and an hour or so later the message came back that the Admiral would see her at 1330. So, at 1315, she presented herself at the Admiral's office suite, where Commander Adderin happened to be delivering a pile of cubes.
How's Holland Architecture, Lieutenant?
Very interesting, sir. Major Patak has me taking some courses since I had no background.
Good. She's very thorough. Has she given you the ship test yet?
That came first, sir.
Ah, well, you must have passed or I'd have heard about it. Good for you. How are you getting along in the junior mess? Settling in all right?
Fine, sir.
This ship's so big, none of us can get to know everyone. Sometimes people coming in from smaller craft find that very unsettling. If you have any special interests, you might take a look at the recreational group roster. We encourage people to have acquaintances outside their own work sections, or even commands.
Well, sir, the Junior's Tactics discussion group did ask me to speak on the Xavier action.
Oh? Well, that's not exactly what I had in mind, but it's a start. When they showed some initiative in asking, who was it?
Ensign Denton, sir.
I don't know Denton. But I'm sure they've all heard something about Xavier and are curious to know more. I might drop in. Ah, the Admiral's ready.
Admiral Dossignol was a tall man with craggy features and big-knuckled hands that fiddled with things on his desk. Despite this, he seemed more relaxed than Captain Haken, and considerably more welcoming.
I've read the notations your board made in your file, Lieutenant Sweeza. And though I can understand their concern about your decisions, I do not share them. I have complete confidence in your loyalty to the Familius Regnant.
Thank you, sir.
No thanks necessary, Lieutenant. Although we need to smoke out the other traitors, we surely have. Garavay and his cohorts cannot be all of them. We must have trust, or we have no cohesion. I understand you and Major Patak are getting on well. And Commander Cerviche.
I've only met him, sir.
I'm sure you heard this before, but I must say it's unusual to have a lieutenant assigned here without having gone through one of the advanced technical schools first. You may find it necessary to take some courses.
I've already signed up for one, sir.
Good. By your record, you're a quick learner. But heavy maintenance is a lifetime study.
The Admiral glanced back at his desk display.
I see you've had recent home planet leave. How did your family react to all the publicity?
They went overboard, sir.
I suppose you mean the medal.
Yes, sir.
But that was the government, not your family. You have a father, stepmother, half-brothers?
Yes, sir. Also aunts, uncles, cousins. It's a large clan, sir.
Do they approve of your joining us?
Not entirely, sir. Not at first. Now they do.
We have no other officers from your planet, you see. The last was some 30 years ago. I wondered why so few. Altiplano is, I understand, an agricultural world. We usually get quite a few recruits from ag worlds.
It's not the usual sort of ag world, sir.
And why is that?
No free birthers.
All the other reasons came back to that. With population growth under control, there were no idle hands to ship off planet. Immigrants had to agree before they were accepted. If they already had reproduced, they had to agree to preemptive sterilization.
But your family, how many sibs do you have?
Two, sir, but they're my father's second wives on her permits.
I see. And their attitude towards rejuvenation?
I know only my father's view and my uncle's. They express concern about the effect on population stability, although the competitive value of ever-increasing experience would have a positive effect.
So the senior military personnel on Altiplano have not been rejuved?
No, sir.
Did you sense any resentment of the Familius on that basis?
No, sir, none. Altiplano's an independent. The Admiral is no doubt aware that we have no sponsor with a seat in Council, and Council policy affects us only in as much as it affects commercial law.
There's been some unrest, especially since the revelation about that mess on Patchcock. There's now a strong political faction opposed to rejuvenation on the grounds that the rich old will exploit the poor unable to afford rejuvenation.
I don't think anyone on Altiplano feels exploited by the Familius, occasionally by each other.
I'm glad to hear it. I'll be seeing you from time to time. Officers of the 14th get together regularly. Commander Adderin will let you know the next event.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
The first thing Esme did after coming back from her interview with the Admiral was pull a diagram of the various commands aboard the DSR. She had thought she understood how the chains of command ran and who reported to whom about what, but several things the Admiral had said left her confused. A few hours later, she was only slightly less confused, but considerably entertained. With very few exceptions, and DSRs were the primary exception, fleet vessels had a simple command structure, with the captain at the top, and authority descending rank by rank through the officers to the enlisted personnel. An admiral aboard a flagship had no direct authority over the ship's crew. All orders had to flow through the regular captain. But the size of the newer DSRs had tempted Fleet to treat them as mobile bases. Rather than maintain separate technical schools and laboratory facilities at Sector HQ, staff had decided to put them aboard the Kosciusko, which needed most of the equipment anyway. Thus, the Kosciusko had multiple commands, each headed by an admiral, which were expected to use the same facilities, and even the same experts, for different purposes. If Fleet had wanted to create a venue for massive turf battles, it could have invented no better arrangement. Esme found the debris of such battles in the files. The Special Materials Fabrication Facility, for instance. It was supposed to serve the 14th Heavy Maintenance Yard by making all the materials needed to maintain an inventory of structural members. But it also served the senior technical schools, where students learned to make such materials, and the Special Materials Research Lab, where the most inventive materials scientists struggled to develop new materials with exotic properties. On the first deployment, a massive fight developed between the 14th Heavy Maintenance, which wanted a larger inventory of the crystal-bonded structural members for repair, and the other two commands, which insisted that they needed a guaranteed minimum access to the facility to fulfill their missions. That argument had risen through the various chains of command until the admirals involved were, as one report put it, locked in a room to fight it out until only one emerged victorious. The solution, a compromise reached with all admirals still alive and kicking vigorously, satisfied no one. But its inconvenience suggested that complaint would only make things worse. Even the traditional division between the ship's crew and its passengers had eroded. Though in theory, Captain Haken had the ultimate authority for the ship's security and functioning, his crew was outnumbered many times by the personnel of the 14th Heavy Maintenance Yard. When a previous yard commander wanted to run an outrigger tube between T3 and T4, between the lateral docking bays, he'd done so. Esme found the furious correspondence launched by the then-captain to the admiral then commanding the 14th Heavy Maintenance, and the directive from Sector HQ that the offending tube would be allowed to remain. The captain had been reassigned. No wonder the ship's architecture didn't match the computer specs, and everyone needed update cubes to keep track of the changes. Above the ship level, the chain of command looked more like a tree diagram. Captain Haken's superior was Admiral Garrosh, commander of this wave, whose superior was the Sector 14 Commandant, Admiral Foxworth. Admiral Dossignol, however, reported directly to the Sector Commandant. He was responsible for all maintenance functions in the sector. Admiral Lavati was Training Command's representative in this sector, and not under the Sector Commander at all. Fleet Headquarters had taken over all training functions 60 years before. Similarly, the Medical Command had its own separate chain, this time running back to Admiral Surgeon General Busey, back at Rockhouse. Her father would never have put up with this mess. On Altiplano, the Military Medical Service was firmly and formally subordinate to the Operational Command.
Yes, that's how he was able to conceal my trauma. No one was going to argue with the hero of a war.
That wasn't fair. She wasn't even sure it had been a military hospital. She wasn't going to think about it anyway. She put the displays away. She understood the command structure well enough now. She could start preparing for her presentation to the discussion group in 2 days. The Kosciusko had a personnel complement the size of a small city or large orbital station, and the officer list alone was as large as the crew of any normal ship. Esme knew that, in the intellectual sense, But when she saw the mass of ensigns jamming the lecture hall and crowding the passage outside, numbers became experience. Ensign Detton had offered to introduce her.
You're not all in the tactics discussion group, surely?
No, sir. But a lot of the others wanted to come. I'll have to shift some of them out because they're overloading the compartment.
Esme could see that. All the seats had been taken long ago. Ensigns were crowded knee to knee in front and were sitting squashed together in the aisles and in back. They were jamming the passage outside, too. She watched Detton trying to shoo them back out to no avail. She should, she realized, have told someone more senior about this. If she'd thought it would be more than a dozen or so ensigns, she would have. Detton wasn't getting anywhere, and it was her responsibility. She reached for the microphone.
Excuse me. How many of you are regular members of the tactics discussion group?
A few hands went up, about what she'd expected originally.
This meeting was scheduled for that group. We can't have a mob scene like this. It's not safe. Those of you who are not members of the discussion group will have to leave until we're sure we have seating for that group. And then we'll see how many others we can accommodate.
These were ensigns, and she was a full lieutenant now. Squirming awkwardly, those crammed into the aisles began to stand up. Those in front waited, perhaps hoping for a reprieve, but Esme gave them a stern look. Slowly, more awkwardly than necessary, they heaved themselves up and shuffled out. Some of those in seats were now standing. Some sat as if glued in place. She hoped those were all discussion group members.
Ensign Detton?
Detton looked mildly embarrassed.
Make sure all the discussion group members have seats. You know them all, don't you?
Yes, sir.
When they're seated, and if it's agreeable to the others, I don't mind having any spare seats filled, but that's all.
Sir, all here but two. They may be outside.
Go check on them. By name.
He made his way up the crowded aisle and called out into the passage. A knot of ensigns congealed in the opening, and finally two more elbowed their way in. That left seats for another two dozen, Esme figured. She wished she knew a fair way to allocate those seats, but it was too late for that. More quickly than they'd left, more ensigns came in until all seats were filled.
Well, I'm pleased to introduce Lieutenant Esme Sweeza, who I'm sure really needs no introduction. She agreed to speak to us about the Xavier incident, which needs no introduction either. So, Lieutenant?
The lights dimmed, except where Esme stood. The eager young faces faded into a blur with highlights of eyes and teeth. She had not expected that, but after standing in the glare of Flag Officer's disapproval, she was not about to crumple in a merely visual spotlight. She had prepared a display cube with the same information given in court: the geometry of the Xavier system, the disposition of fleet vessels, available Xavierin and civilian vessels, the number and armament of the invaders. She had been over this so many times for her counsel and for Board of Inquiry and for the court-martial that she could have explained in her sleep just how outnumbered Serrano had been even before Hearn defected. Breathless silence while she spoke, reciting the familiar sequence. Some of it she knew only by report, and she said that. But the events themselves were so compelling that no one seemed to mind. The Benignity intrusion, the lagging pair of Benignity ships, possibly a new tactic, possibly malfunction. No one knew for sure. The successful attack on those ships, the damage to one assault carrier, the effective ambush of the killer scout sent to form its own ambush, the long and dangerous harrying of the invaders in their course to Xavier, the loss of the space station, the damage to the Xavierin cities.
Only a scorch, after all.
Esme stopped short. She could not see against the glare of light focused on her who had spoken.
Only a scorch. Someone thinks a scorch is a minor problem? Let me show you the video.
She switched to that. The former capital of Xavier on one side of the screen, as it had been, a small city of wide streets and low stone buildings, gardens, and tree-shaded parks. That was file footage from fleet databanks. Xavier's own records had all been destroyed. On the half-screen, an uneven field of rubble. The shattered remains of trees, the languid columns of smoke twisting in their own heat, a damage assessment team from Fleet in their protective gear. The video pickup had zoomed in on dead bodies, human and animal. Esme recognized a dead horse, if no one else did.
All population centers were reduced like this. Fire destroyed outlying settlements, as well as millions of hectares of pasture and farm crops. A scorch is intended to leave the planet barely habitable for the Benignity's own troops, with return to agriculture production in 3 to 5 years. That doesn't leave much for the people who live there.
But weren't they all killed?
No, thanks to the foresight of Commander Serrano and their own government. Most of the population survived in remote regions. They have caves, I heard. But their economic base is gone. It will take a generation or two just to recover what they lost.
Esme could imagine the sequence. The years of hunger, while they reestablished their agricultural base. The years after that, when just enough to eat was no longer enough. As distant as they were, they could not expect much help from the rest of the Familius, once some new crisis caught public attention. Silence again, this time with a different flavor. Esme changed displays to show the Xavier system again.
Let's begin with the situation as it first appeared to Commander Serrano. Xavier had been troubled by periodic incursions over the past few years that appeared to be independent raiders of some sort. These had threatened the orbital station and, in fact, had damaged it on more than one occasion. Xavier's only defense consisted of outmoded, undersupported Demoiselle-class ships, of which only one was really spaceworthy. The others had been cannibalized for parts to keep that one working. The government enlisted Commander Serrano, then acting as a civilian captain of a private yacht, but a very well-armed one, in defense against such a raider. As you might expect, the unsuspecting raider didn't have a chance.
How big was it?
According to scan reports at the time, it was an Athar's World raider. Commander Serrano anticipated its attack course and was able to surprise it.
But that wasn't the whole battle, was it? One lousy little raider?
No, of course not. Commander Serrano's scan techs noticed another ship in the system, which appeared to be an observer. She suspected that the raider's attack was merely a probe for a larger invasion force. She transmitted that concern to the nearest fleet headquarters.
And got a bunch of traitors.
Not a bunch. Most of the officers and crew of all three ships were loyal, or things would have turned out very differently. Fleet dispatched a small force under the command of Deccan Garavay. 2 patrol ships, 1 cruiser. The captains of all 3 ships were prepared to cooperate with the Benignity. The problem for the Benignity, as I understand it, is that the sort of thing they planned at Xavier required their long-standing agents to identify themselves to each other. A very risky affair. This need to confer was their undoing. Commander Serrano had to prevent Garavay from destroying Xavier's orbital station, and she needed those ships to defend from the expected invasion. That meant she had to relieve Garavay and the other traitors' captains of their commands, identify any other traitors, and rally the loyal crews.
But how did Serrano get command?
I can only tell you what I heard. Apparently, she and some of her former crew got aboard by some ruse and asked to talk to Garavay in his office. By good fortune, or perhaps she had some way of knowing, some of the other conspirators were there. She and her crew killed them.
Right away? You mean they didn't try to talk them out of it?
When someone has determined on treason, is commanding a ship and planning to deliver helpless civilians to the enemy, I doubt any moral homilies would change his mind. Commander Serrano made a command decision. She eliminated the most senior conspirators as quickly as possible. Even then, it wasn't easy.
Esme put up new displays.
Now, Captain Hearn took to spite, with me and the rest of the crew quickly out of Xavier's system. Our exec was also involved, but the next junior officer was both loyal and on the bridge to hear Commander Serrano's transmission to Captain Hearn, requesting her to return to station and her assistance in defending Xavier. He actually began the mutiny, appealing to the bridge crew.
She stopped, flooded in memories of the next few hours. The contradictory orders on the ship's internal communications, the total confusion, the time it took, which now seemed inexplicable, for the loyalists to realize that a mutiny was necessary and that they'd have to use deadly force on their crewmates.
From the tactical point of view, Commander Serrano faced a very difficult task. The Benignity force arrived almost simultaneously with her assumption of command.
Now, describing decisions and actions she had not personally witnessed, she found it easier to be calm and logical. This ship here, these over there, expected and unexpected choices of maneuver. Results, neatly tabulated without reference to the people whose lives had just been changed forever. All too soon, she had to come back to her own experience. Esme displayed another visual.
We came in too fast. My concern was that we might arrive too late, and I assumed that any insertion barrage would be sufficiently dispersed. So we blew past Xavier, and in that interim, Paradox took fatal damage.
More than 1,800 dead. Her fault. War left no margin for mistakes. She remembered the desperate scramble on the bridge of her ship, the bridge crew fighting to get control, to get a jump solution that would let them get back in time to do some good.
We got a jump solution, and we came out of jump with a clear shot of the rear of the Benignity Command cruiser.
And a vector that gave them only one chance for that shot. The crew that had resented losing a chance to become the sector gunnery champions had made their shot in the narrow window, and then had managed to reposition Despite in a stable orbit.
The Board of Inquiry did not approve of the means, though they liked the results.
Esme didn't want to discuss that. She hurried on to show how the Xavierin defenses had contributed, the suicidal use of phase cannon on a shuttle, the improvised mines, Little Grogan's few telling shots, the yacht's astonishing defeat of the killer ship.
Only because they weren't expected. The Benignity ship intended ambush. Post-battle analysis picked up enough transmissions to know that, and simply didn't know the yacht was there. When it shut down active systems to lie low for several hours, it was an easy target.
What difference would it have made if Despite had also been in the Xavier system the whole time?
By the ship's stats, it would have improved the odds ratio only about 15%. To my own knowledge, Despite had the best weapons performance in the sector. But if it had stayed, it would have been a known quantity, and Commander Serrano's force would still have been outnumbered and outgunned. I haven't seen any of the senior analyst reports, but my own guess is that its contribution throughout the long battle would have been less than its effectiveness as an unexpected opponent at the end. That is, however, only my guess. It does not change the fact that the lack of another hull severely limited Captain Serrano's choices of action, and that its absence was the result of treason.
The audience paused, attentive and almost breathless. Esme waited. Finally, someone shifted, and that broke their immobility. Hands rose for more questions, but Esme caught sight of senior rank in the rear.
When did they come in?
Well, Lieutenant Suiza, on behalf of the whole tactical group, I'd like to thank you for a riveting presentation.
Detton saw them, finally.
Sir?
Commander Atterin, Esme finally recognized as he moved out of the dimness back there and into the light.
I presume you'd be willing to give the same briefing to senior officers?
A shiver of apprehension ran down Esme's backbone. She couldn't tell if he was angry or amused. She didn't know whether to apologize or explain.
Of course, sir.
She choked back the automatic qualifiers. If she wasn't really qualified, why was she showing off to the ensigns?
If I could have a word.
Adarin's glance raked the ensigns, who immediately began scrambling from their seats to leave by the other entrance.
Of course, sir.
Esme retrieved her display cube from the projector and came down from the dais. Major Patak was not one of the officers there, and she didn't recognize any of the others besides Adarin. They gazed at the departing ensigns with the kind of neutral expression which she interpreted as trouble on the half-shell and bubbling from the broiler. Atterin said nothing more until the ensigns had gone.
Very clearly explained, I thought. I was impressed with your analysis of your own errors. Well, Lieutenant Suiza, I think you'd better expect an invitation to the Senior Tactics Discussion Group. I quite realize that you aren't a senior analyst, but I doubt we can resist having a first-hand account of so striking an engagement.
Yes, sir.
And you might want to check the orientation of your Illustration 8. I think you've got the axes rotated 90 degrees, unless there is a reason for that.
Yes, sir.
With a nod, Atterin led the other officers out. Esme felt like falling into one of the seats and shaking for a half hour, but Detton was peering in at her, obviously hoping to chat. Commander Atterin thought it prudent to report to Admiral Dossignol about Esme's presentation.
So you don't think she's rousing the ensigns to any sort of undesirable activity?
No, sir. You know how ensigns are. They'll go after anyone with real experience to talk about. They love gory stories, and that's what they were hoping for. Instead, she gave them a perfectly straightforward account, as unexciting as possible, of an innately thrilling engagement. Absolutely no self-puffery at all, and no attempt to romanticize Commander Serrano, either. I've invited her to address the Senior Tactics Discussion Group. She'll get more intelligent questions there, but I suspect she'll answer them as well.
I don't want to make her into some sort of hero. It'll rile our touchy captain. Too much attention.
Sir, with all due respect, she is a hero. She has not sought attention. From her record, she never did. But she saved Serrano's ship and Xavier, and we can't pretend it didn't happen. Letting her discuss it in professional terms is the best way to ensure that it doesn't become an unprofessional topic.
I suppose. When is she speaking? I'd like to be there.
The meeting after next. We have that continuing education required lecture next time.
Esme reported to duty the next day, having spent most of the night awake with nightmares.
I hear you had an interesting evening. How does it feel to have an overflow audience? Ever thought of being an entertainer?
I wish they hadn't asked me.
Patak's eyebrows rose.
Sorry, I just would rather put it behind me.
Oh, it's behind you, all right. Just as a thruster's behind a pod, pushing it ever onward. Face it, Sweeza, you're not going to be an anonymous member of the pack ever again.
Esme couldn't think of anything to say.
Listen to me. You don't have to convince me that you're not a glory hound. I doubt anyone who's ever served with you or commanded you thinks you're a glory hound. But it's like anything else. If you stand in the rain, you get wet. And if you do something spectacular, you get noticed. Face it. Deal with it. And, by the way, did you finish with that cube on whole specs of minesweepers?
Yes, sir.
Esme handed it over, hoping the topic had turned for good.
I hear you're on the schedule for the senior tactics discussion group.
Esme managed not to sigh or groan.
If you've got any data on the hull damage to Serrano's ship, I'd like to hear about it. Also, the Benignity assault carrier that blew in orbit. Mines, I think it was. It would be helpful to know a little more about that. The mines and the hull both. I realized you weren't in the system for long afterwards, but perhaps...
Yes, sir.
Not that it's tactics proper, but data inform tactics, or should. I expect Commander Serrano made use of everything she knew about HNA.
Forewarned by this exchange, Esme was not surprised to be buttonholed by other senior officers in the days that followed. Each suggested particular areas she might want to cover in her talk, pertaining to that officer's specialty. She delved into the ship's databanks in every spare moment, trying to find answers and anticipate other questions. Amazing how connected everything was. She had known the obvious for years, how the relative mass of Benignity and fleet ships governed their chosen modes of action, but she'd never noticed how every detail, every subsystem, served the same aims. Even recruitment policy, which she had not really thought of as related to tactics at all. If you threw massive ships in large numbers into an offensive war seeking conquest, you expected heavy losses and needed large numbers of troops, both space and surface. Widespread conscription, especially from the long-conquered worlds, met that need for loyal soldiers. Recent conquests supplied a conscripted civilian workforce for low-level, labor-intensive industries. A force primarily defensive, like the Familia's regular space service, manning smaller ships with more bells and whistles, preserved its civilian economic base by not removing too many young workers into the military. Hence, hereditary military families who did not directly enter the political hierarchy. Fascinating, once she thought about it this way. She couldn't help thinking what widespread rejuvenation would do to this structure, stable over the past 100 or more years. Then she surprised herself when she anticipated the next set of hull specs on Benignity killer escorts, on their choice of hull thickness for assault carriers.
How did I know?
You're a Sweeza.
Surprise overrode the automatic thought that she must have seen it before somewhere. She couldn't possibly be smart enough to guess right. By the time of her second presentation, she felt stuffed with new knowledge barely digested. She'd checked her illustrative displays. Yes, number 8 had been rotated 90 degrees from the standard references, and assembled what she hoped were enough background references. Esme lugged her carry-all of cubes and printouts into the assigned conference room. This was a large hall in the technical school's wing, T1, its raked seating curved around a small stage.
Looks like you came prepared.
I hope so, sir.
Esme could think of 24 more cubes she might need if someone asked one of the less likely questions. She had come early, hoping for a few minutes alone to set up, but Patak, Commander Ceviche, and Commander Adarin were already there. Her chain of command, she realized.
Would you like any help with your displays? The remote changer in this room hangs up sometimes.
That would be helpful. Yes, sir. The first are all set up on this cube, but I've got additional visuals if the group asks particular questions.
Fine, then. I've asked Ensign Serrano to make himself available. I'll call him in.
Serrano. She hadn't met him yet, and after what she'd said at dinner, no one had gossiped more about him in her presence. She hadn't wanted to seek him out. What could she have said? I saved your aunt's life, your grandmother talked to me, let's be friends? No. But she had been curious. Her first thought when he walked in was that he had the look of a Serrano. Dark, compact, springy in motion, someone whose entire ancestry was spangled with stars, someone whose family expected their offspring to become admirals, or at least in contention. Her second was that he seemed impossibly young to bear the weight of such ambition. If he had not worn ensign's insignia, she'd have guessed him to be about 16 and in the prep school. She had known there were young Serranos, of course, even before she got to the Kosciusko. They could not be hatched out full-grown as officers of some intermediate grade. They had to be born and grow like anyone else. But she had never seen it happen, and the discovery of a young Serrano, younger than she was, disturbed her. The glint in his dark eyes looked very familiar.
Lieutenant Sweezer, this is Ensign Serrano.
Sir.
He twitched as if he would have bowed in other circumstances.
I'm supposed to keep your displays straightened out.
Very well.
Esme handed over the cube with her main displays and rummaged in the carryall.
That one's got the displays that I know I'll need. And here, this is the outline. They're in order, but in case someone wants to see a previous display, these are the numbers I'll be calling for. Now these...
Esme gave him another three cubes.
These have illustrations I might need if someone brings up particular points. I'm afraid you'll have to use the cube index. I didn't know I'd have any assistance, so there's no hard copy listing. I'll tell you which cube and then the index code.
Fine, sir. I can handle that.
Esme had no doubt he could. Other officers were arriving, greeting each other. Ensign Serrano took her cubes and went off somewhere. Esme hoped to a projection booth, while she organized the rest of her references. The room filled, but arriving officers left a little group of seats in front, as if they'd had stars painted on them. Admiral Dossignol nodded at her. He seemed even taller next to Captain Haken. On the captain's other side, Admiral Levati fiddled with his chair controls, and Admiral Upanos, commander of the branch hospital, leaned toward his own aide with some comment. Atarin stood to introduce Esme. With the Admiral's arrival, the meeting started. Esme began with the same background material. No one made comments, at least not that she could hear. All her displays projected right side up and correctly oriented. She had checked them repeatedly, but she'd had a nagging fear. This time, her recent research in mind, she added what she had learned about the Benignity's methods, about the implications of fleet protocols. Heads nodded. She recognized an alert interest far beyond the ensign's hunger for exciting stories. When the questions began, she found herself exhilarated by the quality of thought they implied. These were people who saw the connections she had only just found, who had been looking for them, who were hungry for more data, more insights. She answered as best she could, referencing everything she said. They nodded and asked more questions. She called for visuals, trusting that the Serrano ensign would get the right ones in the right order. He did, as if he were reading her mind. The talk went on. They wanted to know every detail of the damage to Despite from the mutiny. What weapons had been used, and what bulkheads had been damaged. What about fires? What about controls? The environmental system fail-safes, the computers? The admirals, who had sat quietly listening to the questions of their subordinates, started asking questions of their own.
I'm sorry, sir, I don't know that.
Esme found herself saying that more often than she liked. She had not had time to examine the spalling caused by projectile hand weapons, to assess the effect of sonics on plumbing connections. Esme wondered how long it would go on. Finally, Atarin stood, and the conversation died.
We're running late. We need to wrap this up. Lieutenant, I think I speak for all of us when I say that this was a fascinating presentation, a very competent briefing. You must have done a lot of background work.
Thank you, sir.
It's rare to find a young officer so aware of the way things fit together.
Sir, several other officers asked questions ahead of time, which sent me in the right direction.
Even so, a good job, and we thank you.
The others nodded. Esme was sure the expressions held genuine respect. She wondered why it surprised her, why her surprise made her feel faintly guilty. The admirals and the captain left first, then the others trailed away, still talking among themselves. Finally, they were all gone, the last of them trailing out the door. Esme sagged. Ensign Serrano returned from wherever he'd been, running the projector, and handed her the stack of cubes.
That was impressive, Lieutenant. And you kept track of which display went with which question.
And you handled them perfectly. It can't have been easy when I had to skip from one cube to another.
Not that difficult. You managed to slide in those volume numbers every time. You certainly surprised them.
Them?
Your audience. Shouldn't have. They had recordings of the talk you gave the juniors. This was just fleshed out, the grown-up version.
Thanks.
The young Serrano gave her a cheerful nod before taking himself off somewhere. Since she didn't have another public appearance to get ready for, Esme headed for the gym when she came off shift. She'd missed out on her regular exercise. The gym was crowded at this hour, but almost at once one of the machines came vacant, and the jig who'd been leaning against the bulkhead waiting waved her on. Esme climbed onto the machine and set it for her usual workout. She'd been aware of quiet competition to have the machine next to hers in the exercise room, the eagerness to invite her onto wall ball teams despite her indifferent play, the little favors offered casually. She supposed it would go away in time, when people forgot about her so-called fame. She had never had really close friends in Fleet, and she didn't expect to acquire any now. Her mind hung on that thought.
Why shouldn't I have friends? If people like me, and they seem to.
It was only her transient fame. It had nothing to do with her real self. She worked harder until she was breathless and sweating, and all thought of friends had vanished in the struggle for breath and strength. At dinner, she listened to the chatter at her table with a mind uncluttered by worry about a coming presentation. Ensign Zintner's enthusiasm for hull and architecture reminded her of Lucy's uncomplicated enthusiasm for stock breeding. She could like Zintner. She glanced around the mess hall and found another female lieutenant watching her. It made her feel itchy, and she looked back at her plate. The hard workout had damped her appetite. She would be hungry in 3 hours, but not now. On her way out, two other lieutenants stopped her.
If you don't have duty tonight, would you like to come watch a show with us?
They had asked before, but she had been preparing for the discussion group presentation. Now she had no excuse ready. She agreed to come, expecting to slip away after a few minutes. Instead, she found herself locked into a row of others with someone leaning over the back of her seat to speak to her. When the show started, she had that much peace, but as soon as it was over, she found herself the center of attraction. It was ludicrous. It could not be real liking, real interest. It was only her notoriety. She hated herself for enjoying it, even the small amount that she did enjoy. She shouldn't like it. The only legitimate way for an Altiplano woman to be the center of attention was as matriarch of a family. Her great-grandmother would scold. Her great-grandmother was light years away, if she was still alive. Esme shivered.
Are you all right, Esme?
She looked over. A lieutenant, Carton Dublos. So the use of her first name was not familiarity, but the normal usage between those of the same rank off-duty.
I'm fine. I just thought of my great-grandmother.
Dublos looked puzzled, but shrugged it off. Over the next weeks, Esme noticed that the interest in her, the competition for her attention, did not slack off. It puzzled her.
What do they hope to gain? What are they trying to prove?
Tickling at the edge of her mind were all the things Admiral Serrano had said, that legal counsel had said, and her father, and Major Patak. She pushed them aside. She could not cope with a demand to break out of the comfortable, safe niche she had created for herself. She would crawl back into it, pull it around her, an inviolable shield. The nightmares came more often. Further proof that she was not, could not be, the person these others seemed determined to see. Not every night, but especially after those times when someone had talked her into a game, a show, some recreation which had, as far as she could tell, no connection with the content of either set of dreams. She started running a noise generator in her compartment, hoping it would cover any sound she made. No one had complained, but when she woke, heart pounding, at 0300, she was always afraid she had cried out in real life the way she had in the dream. The dreams tangled, the helpless child caught in a war she did not understand, merging abruptly into the terrified young officer, belly down on a bloody deck, firing into the haze. She considered going to medical. She would have to, if it affected her performance. So far, it had not, that she could tell. Patak seemed pleased with her progress. She got along fine with Master Chief Sivers, whose massive frame was so unlike Seb Caron's that she was startled only occasionally by the same kind of attitude. At the quarterly review, Commander Ceviche looked at Major Patak.
And how is Lieutenant Suiza shaping, Major?
Patak looked down at the record cube she held.
Very well, of course. She's worked hard to get herself up to speed. Though she has no background in heavy engineering, and she'll never be the technical help that Bascock was.
She shouldn't be technical track at all. That presentation to the senior tactical came out of a command track mind.
She asked for technical.
The quirk in the corner of Admiral Dossignol's mouth that his subordinates knew meant he was playing devil's advocate.
I think it was the colonial background. I looked up Altiplano's cultural index. Even though she's a general's daughter, they have no tradition of women commanders.
Of women in the military, period. I saw the same report.
Well then. And the juniors are around her like bees around honey.
Which she isn't comfortable with. She's muttered to me about it, claims not to understand it. If that's honest, and I think it is, she's got no insight into her abilities.
Which you say aren't technical.
Well, I don't want to overstate it. She's got the brains, and she's applying herself. I can't speak for her qualifications in scan, but she's merely a studious amateur where H&A is concerned. And there's her habit of seeing everything in operational terms.
Example?
Well, she's completed the second course in hull design, and I assigned her a report on the modifications necessary to support the new stealth hardware. I was looking for the usual, what I'd have gotten from Ensign Zittner, where to install it based on its need for power, its effect on the center of gravity, and so on. All technical. What she came up with was an analysis of the performance changes in terms of operational capability. I pointed this out, and she blinked twice and said, "Oh, but isn't that what really matters?"
Yeah, I see what you mean. To her, everything matters because of its use in battle.
Which is what's supposed to matter to us. I know that. But I also know that I personally get sidetracked into neat engineering problems. Technical bits for the sake of technical bits. But she doesn't appear to. And I wonder if she ever did, even in scan.
I doubt it. Because of her record on Xavier, they sent along the entire personnel file, along with all those ordinary fitness reports, in which she came up bland and colorless and mediocre. There are her academy ratings. Guess which courses she topped out in.
Not tactics and maneuver?
No, though she was in the top 5% there. Try military history. She wrote a paper analyzing the Braemar campaign, and was invited to consider an appointment to postgraduate work as a scholar. She turned it down and applied for technical track instead, where she'd never excelled.
That's odd.
It's more than odd. Makes no sense. Can't find anything in the file to show that she was counseled against command track. Though I do find the usual comments about non-fleet family backgrounds in her prep school files. Yet they assigned her to technical track, purely on the basis of her request and her fairly mediocre scores.
What were her personal evaluations?
What'd you expect for an outsider who wasn't pushing for command track? I don't know why we still use those things. If personnel would ever go back and check officer performance against the predictions of the personal evaluations, they'd have to admit they're useless. She came out mid-range in everything except initiative, where she was low average.
On which I'd rate her quite high. She doesn't wait to be told, if she knows what she's doing.
Question is, what do we do about her? We've got her for a couple of years, and we can teach her a lot about maintenance. But is that the best use of her talents?
Ceviche looked at Adarin and Patak.
I'd have to say no, sir, it's not. She's a good speaker, a good tactical analyst. She might make a good instructor. Or
the kind of ship commander she was in the Xavier action.
That's a risky prediction.
True. But compare her even to officers several ranks ahead of her in their first combat command. I think we'd agree that she has abilities she's shown only rarely. Abilities Fleet needs, if she's really got them and can unlock them. I see that as our task, getting this potentially outstanding young officer to show her stuff.
But how, sir? I like the girl, truly. But she's so reserved, even with me, even after this much time. How do we get the lid off?
I don't know. Engineering is my strength, not combat. I know we can't ask Captain Haken because he's half convinced she's a mutineer. But if we all agree that the best use of Lieutenant Sweeza is elsewhere, then at least we'll be looking for opportunities to nudge her that way.
When I think of all the youngsters who fantasize being heroic ship captains, all the untalented children of famous families, and here's a shy, inhibited genius who just needs a good kick in the pants.
I just hope we can administer that kick in the pants before life does.
However hard we kick her, reality can do worse.
Amen to that.
Esme had not run into the Serrano ensign for some time. She had seen him occasionally, playing wall ball or working out with someone on the mats, but he had never approached her. Now the rotation in table assignments put him at hers. She nodded at him as the others introduced themselves.
You're in remote sensing, aren't you, Ensign?
Yes, sir.
Your first choice?
Actually, no, but I had a short-term assignment right out of the academy, and then I was off schedule for normal ship rotations.
A jig to his right looked up from his meal.
It's a wonder. I thought Serrano's got whatever they wanted.
The Serrano ensign stiffened for an instant, but then shrugged.
It's a reputation perhaps not quite deserved.
And what's your specialty?
What was the jig's name? Plect or something like that.
I'm taking an advanced course. I'm doing research in low-temperature material fabrication, but probably nobody would understand it unless they were working in the field.
Esme considered her options. He was making enough of an idiot of himself already.
I'm sure you're very good at what you do.
It was still too much. Two of the ensigns, but not Baron Serrano, almost choked on their soup. On the way out, she got two invitations to come watch the junior officers' Parpon semifinals match.
No, thank you. I really should spend some time in the gym myself.
It was not an excuse. She was still having trouble with nightmares any time she did not work out to exhaustion. She was sure she would outlast them in time, but for now she was spending a couple of hours a day in the gym. The Parpon matches had thinned out the gym. Esme saw only three others, each engrossed in his or her own program. Someone had left the display wall on its mirrored setting. She faced her reflection and automatically looked away from the face. Her legs, she saw, looked hard and fit. She should probably do more with her upper body, but wasn't certain what. She didn't feel like swimming or using the machines designed for upper body building. What she wanted was a scramble up some rocks. Nothing really hard, but movements less regular than a machine would demand.
Excuse me, Lieutenant.
Esme jumped, then was furious with herself for reacting that way. She looked. It was Ensign Serrano, with what she privately considered that look on his face.
Yes?
I just wondered if the Lieutenant would like a sparring partner.
Esme stared at him in sheer surprise. It was the last invitation she'd expected from a Serrano. From him.
Not you.
It got out before she could censor it. He flushed, but looked stubborn.
Not me? Why?
I thought you were different.
This time he understood. The flush deepened, and then he went as pale as a bronze-skinned Serrano could and pulled himself up.
I don't have to suck up to you. I have more influence in my family...
Esme knew what he would have said, could have said. With the Serrano Admiralty behind him, he didn't need her.
I liked you. Yes, my cousin mentioned you, and yes, of course I saw the media coverage, but that's not why.
Esme felt guilty for misjudging him, and perversely annoyed with him for being the occasion of her misjudgment.
I'm sorry. It was very rude of me.
You're apologizing?
Of course. I misinterpreted your actions.
But you're... It's just, I don't think it needed an apology. Not from a lieutenant to an ensign, even if you did misunderstand my motives.
But it was an insult. You had a right to be angry.
Yes, but you making a mistake and me being angry isn't enough for an apology like that.
Why not?
Because...
He looked around. Esme became aware of unnatural silence, and when she looked, saw the other exercisers turning quickly away.
Not here, sir, if you really want to know.
I do.
While she had a captive informer willing to explain, she wanted to know why. Because it had bothered her for years that fleet officers routinely shrugged off their discourtesies without apology.
Then, no offense intended, we should go somewhere else.
For once, I wish this was home. You'd think on a ship this size it'd be someplace quiet to talk that didn't imply things.
If the lieutenant would consider a suggestion?
Go ahead.
There's always the wall up in the gardens.
Gardens don't imply things?
They certainly did on Altiplano, where "there in the garden" meant knowing smirks and raised brows.
No, the wall, the climbing wall. Even if you haven't ever climbed a real rock.
I have. You mean they have a fake rock wall?
Yes, sir. And the Parpon match is on the way.
I always heard Serranos were devious. All right. I'd like to try this fake cliff.
The cliff, when they arrived, was festooned with would-be climbers wearing all the accoutrements of their sport. Esme stared up at the safety line swinging from overhead.
Sorry, I thought they'd be gone by now. It's past the time the climbing club usually finishes, and no one else ever seems to use it.
Never mind. They're not paying any attention to us.
Esme examined the cliff closely. The indentations the climbers were using for their feet and hands were molded fiber ceram, attached to the cliff face with metal clamps.
Looks like fun.
Baron peered upward.
It is, though I'm not very good at it. But one of my bunkies is an enthusiast, and he's dragged me along a few times. That's how I know when they're usually done.
Come on up!
Esme fitted her hand into one of the holds.
I don't think so. I don't have any gear. And besides, we had a conversation going.
Conversation or an argument? Sorry, sir.
No offense taken.
Around the base of the fake cliff, decorative rock-like forms had been placed to mark off the climbing area from the garden beds. Esme found a comfortable niche and sat down.
I'm not letting you off, though. If you can explain the protocols of apologies and fleet, I'll be forever grateful.
Well, as I said, what you called an insult is not that important. I mean, unless you really wanted my friendship, and that's personal. Is it on your world?
On her world, duels would have been fought, and honor would have been satisfied for the apologies Fleet never bothered with. Would he think her people barbaric because they cared?
It's different. We do tend to apologize easily for things.
So that's why Command... Some people think of you as tentative.
Esme wondered which commander.
They do?
Yes. At least that's what I've heard some people say. You apologize for things we... Sorry, most of the Fleet families wouldn't. Things we just take for granted. So it seems as if you're not sure of what you're doing.
Esme blinked, thinking back down her years in Fleet, from the prep school on. She had made a lot of mistakes. She had expected to. She had been guided by the family rules. Tell the truth, admit your mistakes, don't make the same mistakes twice, apologize promptly and fully for your errors. How could they think that was weakness and uncertainty? It was willingness to learn, willingness to be guided.
I see. So when you make a mistake, you don't apologize?
Not unless it's pretty massive. Oh, you say you're sorry if you step on someone's foot, but you don't make a procedure out of it. Most mistakes, you own up, of course, and take the responsibility, but the apology is understood.
Is it offensive?
Oh, no, not offensive. A little bothersome if someone's always doing it. It makes seniors a bit nervous because they don't know how sincere it is.
You have insincere apologies?
Of course. You don't.
No.
Esme felt as if she'd ridden out into a dry riverbed and sunk hock-deep in quicksand.
On our world, an apology is always part of taking responsibility for errors. It accompanies action taken to redress the wrong and ensure that the error is not repeated.
That was almost a quote from the conventions.
An insincere apology is like any other lie.
Fascinating. Must be very different. If you didn't know, I mean...
I understand what you mean. It's a new idea for me, that apologies could get me into trouble.
Not trouble exactly, but the wrong idea about you.
Yes, I take your point. Thank you for the information.
You don't have to thank... But you do, don't you? Thanking goes with apologizing. Your world must be terribly formal.
Not to me.
Do the others born into Fleet seem rude to you?
Sometimes. I expect that I sometimes seem rude to you, or them.
Not rude. Very polite. Extremely polite. Even formal. Everyone says how nice you are. So nice they couldn't figure out how you could do what you did.
Esme shivered. Did they really think rudeness went with strength? With the killing way? That someone who said please and thank you and I'm sorry couldn't fight or command in battle? A grim satisfaction flowered briefly. If the Altiplano militia ever came off planet, Fleet wouldn't know what hit them.
I'm not sure myself how I did what I did, besides making a great number of unnecessary mistakes.
Mistakes? You stopped a Benignity invasion.
Not by myself.
Well, no, you weren't out there with your white horse galloping across the stars alone.
Why do you people use that image so much? The white horse thing, I mean. Yes, we use horses on Altiplano, but where did you get the idea that they're all white?
Oh, that's not about you, nor Altiplano. It's from the tale of the White Knights, who all rode white horses and spent their time doing great deeds. Didn't you have that in your libraries?
Not that I know of. Our folk tales ran to Brother Ass and the Cactus Patch, or the Starfolk and the Swimmers of Dawn. The only heroes on horses we knew about were the Shining Horde.
You really do come from another culture. I thought everybody had grown up with the White Knights, and I never heard of the Swimmers of Dawn or Brother Ass. The Shining Horde. That wasn't an ancestor of the Blood Horde, was it?
No, they're just legends. Supposedly, they were people with strange powers who could glow in the dark, without getting too close to atomics.
The climbers, now near the base of the wall, ended that conversation. Esme went over to see what equipment they used, much like that she'd used at home, and was offered more help than she wanted if only she'd join the climbing club. They would teach her. She could start on the easy end.
I've scrambled around on some boulders.
One of the climbers pointed.
Well, you should come join us. We can always use new members, and soon you'll be right up there. It's like nothing else, and this is the only ship I know with a real wall.
He was so clearly entwined in his hobby that Esme felt no embarrassment. He would have welcomed anyone willing to climb off the flat deck.
Come on, just go up a little and let me see how you move. Please?
Esme started up the wall. She had never done as much climbing as her male cousins, but she had learned how to reach and shift her center of gravity without swinging away from the slope. She made it up a meter or so before losing her grip and slithering back down.
Good start. You'll have to come again. I'm Trey Sannon, by the way. If you need climbing gear, there's some in our club lockers.
Thanks. I might do that. When's your meeting time?
Sannon told her, then led the other climbers away. Esme turned to Baron.
And thank you. I'm sorry I misjudged you, and you'll just have to put up with my apology. At least this time.
Gladly.
He had an engaging grin, she noticed, and she felt an impulse to trust him even more than she had already. That night, she slept free of nightmares and dreamed of climbing the cliffs of home with a dark-haired boy who was not quite Baron Serrano.
The Serrano Legacy, Once a Hero, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 1998, Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Elizabeth Demery, Stephen Carpenter, Sherry Simpson, Terrence Aselford, Christopher Graybill, Richard Rowan, James Konacek, Eric Messner, Michael John Casey, Peter Stray, Sonny Lasky, Lily Beacon, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, James Lewis, Colleen Delaney, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornette. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry and Temeskin Wubna. Book adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoyed Once a Hero, be sure to look for the other episodes in the Serrano Legacy series. Available at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Concentrate. Concentrate. And visualize a storm.
Graphic Audio presents...
What? What is this storm?
DC Comics.
This is a Code A emergency. Do you copy?
Justice League of America. Superman. The never-ending battle.
There is power that not even they can overcome.
Where is he?
I have my own reserves, fool!
Hello, Superman. If you can still hear this, you are in the final moments of your life.
Copyright 2008, DC Comics. Justice League of America, Superman, and all related names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics 2008. All rights reserved.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.